this episode of the Talk Data to Me podcast. Today we've got myself, Catherine, Owen and Carrie sitting around the virtual meeting room table to talk about some of the interesting antics and shenanigans that are going on in the general world of data management, not just data protection, but other stuff as well. I suppose we aren't going to get too much further without talking about the WhatsApp decision, the humongous fine for WhatsApp that has been levied by the European Data Protection Board in a collective binding decision, and which we expect will be winding its way slowly into the coffers of the Irish state sometime after it's passed through the filter of various appeals to various courts around Europe and around Ireland. Kerry, you've been digging into this one.
Well, so I think that there's actually a lot to it if you can, you know, force yourself through all 260 plus pages of it. Someone that I was following on LinkedIn pointed out that, you know, like he read through it all and it's 140,000 words, which is in and of itself kind of a fascinating thing. Like when you think about it, you know, 90% of what the decision talks about is how obfuscated and minimalistic the WhatsApp notice was and how difficult it was for users to actually make sense of any of it. You know, talking about the lack of transparency in a variety of different ways, and the fact that the decision itself is equally basically unreadable signals something to me. Now, I do agree with, I know Owen mentioned it, and I know you've mentioned it before, that this will be appealed a lot. But I think that because the European Data Protection Board kind of stepped up and stepped into this and kind of pushed back against the DPC, they're going to be a little hamstrung in terms of how much of a reduction, you know, Facebook/WhatsApp will be able to assert, I think. But that's my opinion. I don't know. What do you think, Dara?
Well, two things on that. One, the fact that this went to the level of a binding decision is, on one hand, it's easy to beat up the DPC for doing it, but on the other hand, someone had to do it first.
Yeah.
There had to be a supervisory authority who would be in the firing line, who would be the canary in the coal mine, who would test the procedures.
Yeah.
And the DPC took that step. So I think for all the criticisms people levy to the DPC, the one thing that I would always argue is that there are two ways to make legal history. The DPC is unfortunately making legal history because they're having to do these things first. Now, I'm speaking of someone who is still waiting to hear back from the Belgians on a cross-border data transfer complaint I filed in January. So on that point, there's an element of the DPC was in an unenviable position. On the other hand, there is the question of the pushback and the decision-making processes. And again, there are examples in the ruling where the EDPB has basically put back in things that the DPC's investigators had formulated.
Right, right.
And that's something that's worth noting. It's not that the DPC necessarily as an entity was getting it wrong. The issue was the decision, the draft decision, and the way that was framed. Things I
right.
would be concerned about, though, is the procedural aspects of introducing a whole additional thing, the Article 5.1a basis for fining, without a right of reply to WhatsApp. That has a procedural fairness issue to it that is arguable. The EDPB has dealt with it in their binding decision. They looked at the issue and then said, we're okay to do it. But I've been involved in board meetings where the board of organizations have said, we're going to do this thing, and then it wound up being litigated later. And the other aspect then is the mechanism by which the fines themselves were actually calculated. The cumulative nature and the cumulative approach that was taken seems to be at odds with the actual language in Article 83 of GDPR. And on that basis, there are two areas where I think, while we welcome the fine, across Europe, large fines that have been levied in haste have been appealed at leisure and have been reduced down by a significant order of magnitude. This is a consistent trend. And my personal view on all of this is we'd be much better off having smaller fines levied more quickly with procedural clarity.
That would actually have a bigger effect. I don't know if I necessarily agree that it was done all that much in haste. This wasn't like the ICO with the British Airways and was the other decision that I am just completely blanking on right now. These weren't those kinds of decisions. This is like, I feel like this has been in the making for some time. I mean, so, you know, I think the initial WhatsApp cases were brought, I want to say in like 2016 or maybe 2018. And there's been multiple ones. This isn't the first. It isn't the only one against WhatsApp. It's certainly not the only one against Facebook. So like there's been, you know, this has been circulating for some time. And I think that like I guess the one thing you can say about having such a wordy ruling is that the DPC did spend a lot of time, and with a certain extent, the European Data Protection Board adding in things, spent a lot of time really justifying their decisions. And I think that that's important, both from an appeals process, but also to signal to other companies, you know, why this stuff is important. You know, like I noticed, you know, when reading through things, you know, a lot of the findings were talking about what you could and, you know, how much detail you had to be able to provide to data subjects. And I think a lot of that stuff, you know, we as privacy professionals kind of have an idea about what detail needs to happen, but I don't think that that always translates to the business. And this, I think, gives much more clarity on the fact that, you know, what WhatsApp / Facebook were doing wasn't sufficient. And, you know, the DPC cited piecemeal approaches in a lot of cases, having multiple websites and blog articles and other nonsense that WhatsApp was doing. In particular, the blog articles citing back to Facebook, which itself required a separate privacy policy or cookie consent. I loved that part. I was like, no, you can't do that. Cause that actually touches on a couple of things. You know, it's not just transparency. It's not just making it legible for the data subject. It's also not, it's also a thing where they can't require lots of hoop jumping. And WhatsApp was very skilled at the hoop jumping. And I think that a lot of companies play this game. They play these shenanigans, particularly with things along legitimate interests and the like. And so I think this opinion will signal that this is not going to work, even in Ireland.
Is
that central to the whole process, though? I mean, on the one hand, you have the DPC, and everyone gives out about the DPC, that, you know, supposedly Europe's regulator, and they've come up with a decision for this WhatsApp investigation. They've gone back to Europe. I do agree with Dara that if you've never write a reply to an allegation put you, it's likely to fall on appeal. I do see that, but I think even just the process of getting everything out there, it's like, if it's our problem, what do we think about it? And then you have it just catalogued. And I have to say, I mean, it's clearly a complex problem if it's going to be that long of an answer to, putting out the decision. I mean, it's like wading through mud reading the decision. But it could be, I have to say, I agree with both of you. This could be the line in the sand.
I'd agree with you there, Owen, as well. Just kind of bouncing back to something that Dara touched on there, when it comes to the interpretation of Article 83, because this is again something new. This is something where the Data Protection Commission is the one that's having to, out of all of the regulators, test the waters here, and they took the conservative interpretation of what they saw the text said. And again, this is like in, you know, page 61 of the decision, where they have a section talking about the interpretation of Article 83. And it's really what they're going is, from what we read in the legislation, you know, we're giving the highest fine we can interpret from what we see what the legislation says. And the other supervisory authorities and the European Data Protection Board as a whole disagreed on their conservative interpretation of what the law actually says, as opposed to what they'd like it to say. So it's, I think, going to be potentially very much a landmark once everything gets appealed there, as how you actually interpret powers of all of the authorities, not just the DPC, to fine the various offending controllers and processors.
And I think that's a key point, taking what you said, Kerry, what Owen said, and what Catherine has said. There's a lot of really good stuff in that opinion. There's a lot of really good stuff in the final decision. There's a lot of really good clarification on what the line in the sand is and what the expectation is in terms of the implementation of the transparency principles under GDPR. There are specific things that WhatsApp would have to do to fix things in that decision. But because of the likelihood of things being appealed, those things are not now going to get fixed. Or certainly, I don't think any lawyer would be advising their client to fix all the stuff that's there that you agree with, and we'll just appeal the stuff you disagree with. You appeal everything. You don't appeal one little bit of it. And that's the issue I have, is that large fines like that are fantastic. It's great when they happen. What we have, though, is open questions from a procedural perspective, potential of appeal, an appeal happening, which will ultimately go to the courts of justice to determine how Article 83 in particular should be interpreted. And while we wait for that, what changes in WhatsApp? Now, I think advising clients, working with organizations, looking at our own training materials, Catherine, there's nothing in the decision that we haven't been saying for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And it's good to have the regulators collectively saying the same thing.
And also, just looking at some of the examples that we have, like you were saying, with the transparency and the jumping through hoops, I have other examples that I've been using in training, but it's useful to have an example that's, given its absolute yes, this is something not okay by the EDPB, instead of me just saying it's not okay, here's why from the data subject's perspective this is not okay.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that bolstering argument, even if this gets appealed in the WhatsApp case, is a strong one, you know, unless the entire judgment gets rejected, which I don't think would happen. You know, at most, I think the fine may get lowered. But, you know, this gives guidance, and it gives something that, you know, we as consultants and practitioners can point back to clients and say, all right, guys, look, you know, it's no longer just theoretical. It's no longer just us, like you said, Catherine, saying this stuff because it makes sense. It's the DPC saying it. I think there's a lot of clients that have pushed back because they say, well, you know, how do you, they kind of want us to like show our work with references.
Yeah.
And
it's not just the DPC, it's the DPC and the entire European Data Protection Board.
Right. And now this is like, all right, guys, you know, for the transparency elements, for the accountability, for the, you know, making it legible and clear. This is great guidance, in my opinion. It's just overly wordy, and we have to synthesize it for people. But that's what keeps us busy. Yay!
Isn't that great? If only we knew a company that specialized in taking stuff that's complex, dense, and legalistic and making it easy for people in organizations to understand. Just to summarize our view on the WhatsApp decision, the bomber is circling the runway, and the bomber is heavily loaded. We're not sure if the fuse has been primed on all the bombs. Is that a pretty good summary?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think that works.
Speaking of rolling thunder and destruction, the UK and its approach to adequacy. You've been looking at this over the past few days, given the UK has again decided that the best approach to proving to its European and international partners that it can be trusted is to take every agreement it gets, throw petrol on it, and set fire to it.
Yeah. I suppose, and we spoke about it before, in terms of the UK. I mean, they got their adequacy, and everyone was worried about the adequacy, and they obviously put a lot of time into getting adequacy decision out of the EU, and then they reveal their hand that it's this big shakedown. they're gonna change the rules. But the big announcement during the week came out that they were gonna, in the great old British spirit, make war on cookies. And that was a really, really interesting headline, because cookie banners annoy people. And they said, well, the government's statement was that this will just get rid of these annoying, pesky things by changing the legislation. Now, obviously, you got that opinion where you think, right, okay, you could change the legislation or you could get rid of the cookies. Now, got either of those. Now, they've gone for the latter.
Yeah. And the other interesting historical point is that the cookie banners were introduced as an industry response on foot of the UK's lobbying in the drafting of the e-privacy directives. Yeah. They created the problem they are now saying is a problem they're going to fix by changing legislation, which they had originally lobbied in favor of.
Yeah, I was about to point that out, that they were instrumental in not getting the enforcement of do not track rather than cookie banners.
Yeah,
I think irony doesn't compute at the moment at the head of the British government. But I suppose the wider point was that this was the cover for this new legislative agenda that they're proposing, and it really. It goes to the heart of how they're looking at data protection, the power of the ICO, it was flagged in Brexit in terms of innovation, scientific innovation and things like that would be part of this new Brexit Britain, where they would attract business based on that, and they could do that freed from the shackles of the EU. But there's quite a lot in there, and the power of the ICO is going to be very, very limited, I think.
Go ahead, Kerry.
I was going to say, what do you guys think about the complete and utter gutting of accountability principles? The lack of DPIAs. They're like, that's great and all, but nah.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this is still just a policy consultation that's been published by the UK government. It's not yet a amendment to the legislation, but it's a very clear roadmap for what they want to do. And removing the accountability principle, removing basic due diligence, removing requirements for data protection officers, they're chipping away at the foundations of the house and their advocacy agreement is built on. All the things that we will be looking for when evaluating other jurisdictions, all the things the European Commission is required to look for, they're chipping away at. That's why I said earlier when we opened this segment of the podcast, they had a perfectly good agreement which they poured petrol on, and they've decided to set fire to it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how the new incoming ICO, John Edwards, the former Privacy Commissioner for New Zealand, deals with this complexity of a political policy position that is at odds with the global trend, which is towards
more accountability.
A common set of core principles for the sorts of things you should be doing with data. Even China is, to an extent, beginning to get it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I mean, it's like the whole, but there's two aspects to that. The whole world is moving towards this whole idea of accountability. There's so much data in all business. But it would be interesting to see where it goes within Britain. I mean, obviously, the government wants to do one thing, and certain sectors of society have governments here. Obviously, business leaders, people like that, who get frustrated by the need for accountability, organization on the back end, things like that. But GDPR, I certainly feel that data protection is really, really embedded in a way that it wasn't, say, 2 years ago when GDPR came into being. And it'll be just interesting to see what kind of kickback you will get, because there are a lot of privacy professionals in work now that maybe are 10 times more than there were in 2018. I don't know, but it'd be interesting. I think that it'll be an interesting dynamic.
It will be, and also for any UK business that's trading out of the UK with other jurisdictions, they're going to have to meet that rising tide. Like, Catherine, Kerry, you're both keeping an eye on what's happening in the US in terms of the US shift on a federal privacy statute or even state level legislation. How bonkers is the US, and is it beginning to sober up?
Yet beginning to sober up, but there is a lot more. Actually, it was one of the interesting things with people's complete and utter misunderstanding of what HIPAA is and does over the coronavirus crisis. People think that they have privacy rights that they don't have. And when they eventually do realize that, A, not only do they not have those rights, but B, other countries do have those rights, there should be more of a groundswell of support for the federal privacy law that various people have been trying to get in and failing to get in because of very large lobbying powers for years at this point. Would you agree, Kerry?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing, right? I think what's going to end up happening ultimately is that the states are going to be the leaders. California, Virginia, Washington. And what's going to end up happening is that eventually the states that aren't doing anything, like all of the South, basically, Texas, those states are going to complain and they're going to say, look, you know, there's inconsistency in the market. California is effectively becoming the default. And we don't necessarily like all the things that California is doing or all the things that Virginia is doing. So please, let's have a federal law. I'm concerned it's going to be an extremely watered down federal law that doesn't really have that much teeth, sort of, you know, like the early iterations of the Privacy Acts going back in the 70s. But I think I still have a lot of skepticism that our politicians are sufficiently motivated enough to get past party line blockers. You know, the Republican Party is intransigent, to say the least, and they will hold out on doing anything that makes the Democrats look good. And so I don't have a lot of faith that anything is going to get done until it absolutely has to, notwithstanding what China and Europe and Brazil and all these other places. Like, the Republicans don't honestly give a shit about what other countries are doing. That's not what they focus on.
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish there between the Republican politicians and various people who still vote Republican, because when it comes to the political attitudes towards privacy across the board with constituents, privacy is one of the areas where everyone could agree. But I think you're absolutely right that at a political level, the legislators, when it comes to the Republicans, they don't want to do anything of the sort.
Yeah, but think about it from the standpoint of like other things where everybody widely agrees. Like, I think that there's wide adoption and wide approval for things like, prescription benefit reform, or like prescription reform in terms of how much prices drugs cost. There's definitely wide agreement on things like minimum wages. But still nothing happens. And it's entirely because there's no real accountability at the political level, on the federal political level.
Kerry, you said they've been looking at California, and California might get all these benefits. So then Texas will want those benefits too, and that will bring about a federal privacy law. But what if something awful happens? Would that not be, if people's standards of, healthcare or something like that get really, really badly affected because they're in a state without a privacy law?
I mean, that's already the case.
In Texas. Really? Yeah, that's really the privacy thing.
No one seems to care. Like, the fact that it's going to be a fascinating experience, for instance, to watch, there's various state and even federal level reforms which are coming in, and insurers are coming in and saying, yeah, we're not going to cover you idiots for not getting vaccinated and getting COVID, for instance, right? People are just going to get bankrupted on crazy levels. I don't think any of that is going to materially change, political will. I really don't, because I don't have much faith in most of my former or fellow countrymen anymore. So
okay, this is veering into a 5 o'clock a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock drinking session call, because you guys need therapy and hugs now, the two.
Yeah, the words political death cult were just about to happen. So.
Okay, so we're going to edit that little bit out in the middle. But getting back to the discussion on the U.S. federal privacy law, and the fact that you have the different states with their different agendas and the political will issue. We're seeing that with the UK and its attitude decision. We're seeing a political approach and a political policy approach driving in the UK what appears to be a reduction in governance and protections around data. But what we're seeing as well post-pandemic, as we begin to emerge from the world as it has been, a lot of governments around the world are looking to encourage businesses of all sizes to invest in digitalization. Ooh, it's a fancy word for doing things with your fingers. And I'm looking at this through the lens of someone who's been working in information management since the 90s. That scares the shit out of me, but I've been at this a long time. And I'm seeing the exact same mistakes being made. I'm seeing the exact same risks being introduced into organizations that possibly don't have the capacity to absorb the expensive cock-up of implementing systems badly and automating processes in the wrong way. Catherine, what's your take?
Well, it comes back to fundamentally understanding what it is you want to do. And taking that back again to the UK's strategy, one of the things that we're seeing is they clearly don't understand what the results of what they say they want to do will be. They talk about the metaphor of quote unquote unleashing the power of data, which is pretty much the exact opposite of what you want to do with power. You want to harness it, put controls around it so that you can guide it and make it useful in the right direction.
If we unleash the power of the atom, that's a bad thing. If we harness the power of the atom, that's a good thing. That's what they taught me in physics.
Yes. And
if we unleash, my dog, that's a bad thing.
Yes. Yes, leashes are good. Controls and guidance are good. And understanding what you want to do and how you need to go about getting the outcomes that you want. So that all the supposed power of this data that you may have is useful, and actually doesn't destroy everything. You need to know where you're trying to go and how to get there. You don't just automate everything because data. You don't just throw big data analytics at everything because it'll just magically work.
But that's how people think the world works. Like you talk to engineers in particular, and it's such a frequent thing that tech will solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the politicians are, ultimately buying into that, and it doesn't, but it's because they fundamentally don't understand the core problems. They don't understand governance. They don't understand obligations and like what digital transformation actually means and if it's practically applicable.
And
ultimately, I hate the phrase digital transformation. I think it's nonsense.
It's a core what the heck are we saying problem, and it's something that I've come across in one of the expert groups I'm working on, where just figuring out what your term is. Are we talking about digital ethics? Are we talking about data ethics, information ethics, tech ethics? There's a whole bunch of relevant things. Digital is the least useful of all the terms. It's the least descriptive of all the terms. And if we're just talking about zeros and ones, we're already dealing with zeros and ones all the time. So
This is something I've been chatting over the past couple of weeks. I've been recording interviews with a number of the data management professionals who I've collaborated with over the years as part of our authors series for our 12th anniversary. And the key thing that's coming out from those guys, and again, it's not just that, it's being on the Leaders Data Group with John Ladley and Tom Redman and Danette McGilvray and people like that. All of us who've been at this a long time are all saying the same thing. We are making the same mistakes again. And we're making the same mistakes again because we're looking at the technology. So what's happening now is the technology has become cheaper to deploy in smaller organizations. Like a decade ago, getting an online HR system for a small business was expensive. Now it's a couple of hundred euros a year. Getting an online getting the online sort of online process automation stuff that we organizations are using, getting an online CRM system, getting an online point of sale inventory management system, all these things were expensive a few years ago, and now they're not. So there's lots of effort and work being done by government agencies and by and other organizations to encourage businesses, for all the right reasons, to use technology differently and better in their businesses. But the problem is, if we don't pay attention to the information component in that, if we focus on, if we don't have an alignment between the business issues, the business needs, the information needs, and the underlying technology, O'Brien's third law of process automation kicks in. Catherine, what's O'Brien's third law of process automation?
Do you want the clean version or the O'Brien's version?
Oh, give me both, and then we'll figure out which one we leave in the edit.
Yes, automating a crap process will just give you a lot of crap a lot quicker.
Automating a bad process badly makes bad shit happen faster you can ever possibly hope to clean up all that shit. And that's what's happening in organizations. So that's my fear. Now, how do we prevent this? How do we help people, Catherine? What do we need to do?
Well, people have to know, first of all, what their intended outcomes are. What do they actually want to do? What are their goals? And they need to work from that to figure out what processes, what technologies will actually be helpful for them. So, you know, again, it's not just, oh, here's what everyone's talking about. This is the newest buzzword. We'll put blockchain on everything.
Oh, God.
Or just AI everything. But yeah, what are your actual needs? What data do you have? What solutions, you know, what problems do you want to solve? Work from the problems that you have that you need to solve, and you know, develop your strategy to meet your own requirements, not the buzzwords.
Yeah. So this is what we're doing. We're doing a lot of work with clients on this at the moment. It's fantastic. In the past couple of months, the number of clients who come to us looking to help them with their data strategy work, translating the nice brochure that someone gave them. I won't even call it a report. It was a brochure, and turn that into actionable things, looking at data governance, looking at data quality to make sure that things work properly. And that's good. We're seeing organizations beginning to embrace that. And it goes back to when I founded Castlebridge back in 2009, the first course that I ran as a trainer was not a data protection course. It was a data quality course. So it's nice to see things are coming full circle. And my concern is the digital transformation hype is the CRM hype of the early 2000s. And the problem we had there was people ultimately confused a strategy with the technology and put all their money into the technology, but didn't actually implement a strategy. And that's where we can help. If people want to get in touch with us, whether it's data protection, data governance, data strategy, or data quality, we have people on the team who can help organizations of all sizes with that. And Catherine, we're rolling out some courses in that over the next couple of months as well, taking some of our old stuff off the shelf and updating it, like a remastered album by Steely Dan or something like that.
Oh, you just dated yourself big time there, Darren. Yeah. Steely Dan, really? Okay.
Yeah. So just another thing to be aware of when it comes to listening to the buzz about digital transformation or data transformation or whatever they're going to be calling it right now, is when you're hearing people talking about the need for data literacy, watch for tool speak. So again, same with the problem of buying all the tools because they're shiny and you've got brochures for them. When you're looking at data literacy as a question, are people talking about understanding your data and what understanding your organization's needs around data and how to get the outcomes you desire using data? Or are they talking about literacy in being able to work with particular tools, which may be a useful thing, but that's technical literacy. And a lot of the time when people talk about digital literacy, they're actually talking about, can you use particular software? Which doesn't help you understand the data at all.
Are we going to say OneTrust in there?
Well, we're not going to go. We will not demean any tool at all. But all I'll say is, if you are thinking data literacy is a particular tool, a particular reporting tool, a particular software for managing data, governance or roles and responsibilities, and you're implementing that and thinking you can tick the box and move on, that you've done the literacy and you've changed your organization. All I'll say is that I go to Woody's DIY on a regular basis, to the Isle of Temptation, and it doesn't matter how many hammers I buy, that does not make me a carpenter.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty we have. It's not just being familiar with tools, it's knowing which is the right tool for the job and understanding what the job is in the first place.
I'm going to date myself here, and I'm going to say that my analogy would be me and a couple of my pals, we used to kind of spend times in recording studios about 20 years ago. And the big thing at the time was you go into the big studio and you get a band in and they want to record their album. There were two tricks that you always do to make them think that they were in the right place. One was you press this button that made all the faders go up and down on their own, okay? And it never, ever, ever meant to make people go, oh my God, this is unreal. And then the second thing is, it didn't matter how badly the recording session went. It just did not matter. If you played the whole thing back to them at the highest volume possible, they always thought it was a really good job. And
did you add reverb?
Well, like whatever, you know, as long as it was loud, especially metal bands, like if it was really, really, really loud, that was a job well done. And then they take it home and it was crap.
That is quite possibly the best analogy to describe data literacy and the technology focus in information management on. It's fantastic. The only question I have, and I'm going to close the podcast on this question, on what button did you press to add the extra cowbell? Okay, guys, we've talked about the WhatsApp decision and how there's good meat in there if we want to get past the headlines. We've talked about UK adequacy decision, where they've taken the adequacy decision they've had. They've introduced a new proposal for policy changes that is basically pouring petrol on their adequacy decision and setting fire to it before the ink was dry. And we've talked about the perils of data, digital transformation, data literacy, and an obsession with technology over actually getting shit done. Thanks, everybody, for taking part in the podcast, and I will talk to you all again soon.